The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
I've seen too many people die. I've seen too many people horribly injured as a result of intentional acts by manufacturers, by the executives of manufacturers, who don't care a thing about people's lives, who only care about their quarterly profit.
Bruce Castor talks about his unexpected career in a niche products liability practice and the long-ago advice from law partner Al Cohn that he carries with him today.
If you do the right thing, you don't have to worry about the money. Too many people get caught up in the finances of this and the money award.
And his optimism on the future of the legal profession.
Who's fighting for those kids down there on the border who get separated from their parents? That's lawyers. Lawyers are the ones who stand up against tyranny. They've done it all over the world, and they're doing it here today. And I couldn't be prouder of the legal profession.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. He describes himself as a trial lawyer, cowboy, hog hunter, and red fisherman, and not always in that order. But then, Bruce Castor is not your typical trial lawyer. His niche practice of suing tire manufacturers over tread defects is an esoteric and technical field of law. He's folksy and full of funny stories, as you'll soon hear, but dead serious when it comes to tire and auto safety. Some of his corporate opponents dismissed him as a country bumpkin from Ocala, but they did so at their own peril. His tenacious consumer advocacy led to an enormous recall of millions of Firestone tires and convinced carmaker Ford to change its product. He's earned a national reputation, including testimony before Congress, fighting for more open records. Bruce Castor sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in July 2018 to share his incredible tale of corporate lies, deceit, and cover-ups, and how his optimism about the practice of law keeps him going.
Bruce, your specialty is auto accidents involving tires with a focus on tire defects that cause tread separations. You're a nationally recognized expert in the field. You've litigated all over the country. How did you get involved in that specialty?
It was really an accident. You know, sometimes doors open in your life and you decide whether to walk through them or not. And sometimes you don't walk through one you should have, and sometimes you walk through one you wish you hadn't. But this is one I was glad I walked through. A young fella here in Ocala had been rendered paraplegic as a result of a auto accident. And the case came to me in a kind of a strange way. I was doing some products liability at that time. This is back in the mid-80s. I wasn't what you'd call a really experienced products liability lawyer. I was an experienced trial lawyer, but I was really just starting to do products liability. Case came to me and I looked at it, and the tread had come off one of the rear tires, and we didn't know whether it was defective or not. That's before people really recognized this defect. So we sent the tire to an expert, and he looked at it and said, nope, no defect. We didn't realize then, because we were so naive about it, I guess you might say, but it's before you really had electronics that you could really Google people and find out things. So I had gone to Atlin and talked to some lawyers, and they said, well, here's a tire expert. And we went to him. He said, nope, nothing wrong with it. Went to a second one. He said, nope, nothing wrong with it. We didn't realize till later they were defense experts. And so, of course, they said there was nothing wrong with it. Sure. We got to a third expert. My partners at that time said, well, you know, you spent all this money on these two experts and there's nothing wrong. We need to give the case up. I said, nah, I kind of think that's like baseball, three strikes before you're out. I'm going to have somebody else look at it because I got a bad feeling about this. So the third guy looked at Kate, saw it, and he said, a guy named George Edwards, who's gone now, but he was the premier tire expert, and he was the mentor for all the rest of them. And George talked to me, and he said, well, yeah, I got to come interview you first. I said, what? He said, well, I don't know where I'm going to take your case till I interview you. So he flew down here and talked to me. He wanted to make sure I was bona fide and that I would go the course. We had a long interview, and he said, yeah, I'm with you. He said, the tire's defective, and he told me why and how it could be fixed. So, you know, we went through, we tried that case. We were about to go to the jury when they settled, and there's a check on the wall around here somewhere. I think it's my first million-dollar, multi-million-dollar check in a case, in a settlement. And that case is very interesting, and I can tell you some how that led to a lot of other tire litigation if you want to hear about it. During the course of the case, and of course this is before you could send emails to people and all that, we had ATLA, and you could take out a little blurb in the ATLA, I want to say weekly magazine, might have been monthly, and to ask questions. And I took out a little blurb, I have a Uniroyal Laredo tire, such and such size, and it failed. Has anybody else ever heard of this? Because I'd gotten interrogatory answers that said, we've never had another case. First of all, they just wouldn't answer them. Went to the judge, I got a court order, they had to answer them, and then they said there has never been another case. So I get a call from a guy in Texas, and it's in that Wall Street Journal article on the wall there. And he said, yeah, I've got one. I said, well, yours isn't a Uniroyal, and I gave him the size. He said, yeah, I got the same size. I said, yours wasn't made in Oklahoma. Yeah, made in Oklahoma. Made the same, like, month mine was made. And they had lied to him as well and said there's no other cases. So I went to my judge and said they violated your order. You know, you ordered them an answer. They gave you a false answer. Boom, boom. So he struck their expert, which made the case a lot easier for me. I wanted him to strike their defenses, but he was smart enough not to do that because those get reversed. So he struck their expert. Well, they brought a bunch of Miami lawyers down here and thought I was a country bumpkin, and maybe I am, but they didn't play well in my hometown. And so it turned out real well. And we did one thing, and I'll kind of end the story with this. We took the other tires, and George said, they're all going to have the same problem. So we took a Sawzall and cut cross sections in one of the other tires. And I told George, I said, just keep that at the bench with you, and on cross-examination, we'll pull it out. So we laid a little trap. So on cross-examination, they started getting on him. You don't know this tire is really defective. He reaches down, he pulls it out, and he holds it up, and he says, here's the companion tire, and it has the same defect. And he stuck a pencil in to show where the tread was separating, and he showed that to the jury. And you could see their mouths all drop open. And you could see all the defense lawyers just totally deflate. Now, instead of thinking I'm the stupid country bumpkin, all of a sudden they're going, oh, damn. They started throwing money at me, and I said, nope, 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 nope. Ended up with the highest settlement in the history of the county up to that point. Wow. And it really wasn't enough money, but my client needed it, and we took it. And then I got a call from somebody with another Uniroyal case, and then I went to Tennessee in that case, and it just built on it. The Wall Street Journal wrote this article about me. The Cleveland Plain Dealer wrote a front-page article about my efforts. And so I became somewhat newsworthy. And news media would come to me with questions about tires.
Sure.
Because there wasn't anybody else really doing it except a friend of mine in Arizona, Tom Dossie, I think was the only other one then. And Billy Edwards in Texas. But anyway, I got a national reputation as a result of those two articles, and cases just kept coming to me.
Now, you're a University of Florida law grad. You've been practicing since 1975, but you first started practicing as a defense attorney for mostly insurance companies. What made you change sides?
Well, that was very lucrative and very easy practice. I mean, it was, you know, you didn't have to work that hard to be a defense lawyer. You just get paid by the hour and you get, you know, it was fine. What finally turned me is not really representing the insurance companies so much, although I got to become somewhat disenchanted with them, but it was representing corporations. I started representing corporations, and what they wanted me to do was to misrepresent and obfuscate and just to do things that were not morally correct. And I just couldn't do that. And I won a case where a guy had both hands, both feet burned off and brain damage that I didn't think I should have won. He got a zero. I begged his lawyer to take money, but they never would really give enough. But I couldn't look myself in the mirror after that. I said, I'm not doing this anymore. So I became a plaintiff's lawyer.
Mm.
And that case with the tire thing came along not too long after that, and now it's a 40-year-old story.
Your extensive knowledge and experience with tire tread separation has led to very large settlements in the years that have passed after that, and verdicts for clients, including a $61.2 million verdict in a Ford Explorer defective vehicle case involving the death of a Miami teenager. That was a very special case for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, not because of the amount, because the amount was really, we knew it would never stand up on appeal, but because of the message it sent. The message it sent and the notoriety that came out of that, where the public really starting to understand how defective the Explorer was and influencing Ford to change their product. I mean, it had a lot of effect. We never really collected that money. We tried the case three times and finally got a good verdict of about $20 million, and that was fine. That was not overturned on appeal, and we resolved it. But what was more important about that case is I learned something that every trial lawyer should know if you do products liability. And that is, unless you have the documents, the internal secret documents, you're never going to get to the truth. I took the deposition of the chassis engineer from Ford, a guy named Mason, who I had memos from that indicated that he had advised in 1989 that the Explorer be widened and lowered because it was unstable. Their internal testing had shown, track testing had shown, the Explorer was unstable just as the Bronco 2 had been. And he made the very logical suggestion, you got to widen and lower it. When I took his deposition, he was working for the legal department at Ford. And I asked him a question, did you ever, you know, make any recommendations that the Explorer be widened? No. Did you ever make any recommendations to be lowered? No. I mean, if you watch this video, it's unbelievable. So then I pulled the documents out. I say, whose signature is this? Oh, that's my signature. Read me what line one says, that the Explorer be lowered. He said, but that's not a recommendation. I said, read me this line before that. Here's my recommendations. So we went like that for an hour of him trying to get out from under a lie. That deposition, I think, has been used by lawyers all over the country in Explorer cases because it showed not only that Ford knew the problem before it was put the vehicle into production, they knew the solution to the problem before they put the vehicle into production, and they didn't do it. And they told Mason, we'll do it in year two. And then the next year, they were going to do it. 10 years later, they still hadn't. So that's part of the evil side of manufacturing, some people would say capitalism, in this country, where greed, and in this case, it was the quarterly bonus of the executives, drive decisions, not engineering, not safety. And even when people are dying, they didn't change it. And they went before Congress and lied about it. If I had known then what I learned in Hall Edwards, there should have been people held in contempt of Congress. But what I learned in Hall Edwards should have led to criminal prosecution for manslaughter, at least. Of course, that was never done. That really reinforced something that I had learned previously, back in a case I had in Arkansas, Hervey Whitaker, which involved a family that was wiped out. The mother was killed, father was killed, oldest son was killed, two teenage boys paraplegic, and they went across the roadway in their vehicle that had a tread separation on the rear and had a head-on collision with Lane Whitaker, another stellar young man, and he was killed. And that case, we really finally got Cooper's internal documents, which eventually led to that statewide litigation in California with over 100 cases against Cooper because of the documents we got there that they had misled courts about for decades.
Could you ever believe that going into a case like that, what you ended up learning in the years afterwards?
The first time that I saw internal documents that made it clear that the corporate representatives and the lawyers had been intentionally misleading judges across the country, it was a sad day, I have to tell you that. And I'm still angry about it because it's never stopped. I'm still getting the same ridiculous arguments today that I got way back then from Cooper Tire Company because they've gotten away with it so many times. They don't get away with it with me.
And your work has led to, among other things, an enormous recall of millions of Firestone ATX tires during that National Ford Firestone litigation with the rollover crashes.
Yeah.
That was a big, big deal.
I'm really proud of that work. I found out about that early on as a result of a case I had in New York City in federal court. Before anything about the recall came out, before people really recognized what was happening, we began to see this pattern. And I'm not mistaken, I have a gag order in that case that prevented me from telling people then about everything I knew. But reporters started seeking me out, and I was learning new things that were not under the gag order. And I started telling reporters what I knew. And then when the story broke, of course, everybody, I think I did 200 interviews to tell the truth about what was happening. And I worked with a lot of other lawyers, Florida lawyers and lawyers around the country on the discovery of the Firestone part of it, depositions. Right. But one of the things I like best about that most people don't know, the Florida Attorney General sent people down here to see me for me to give them a course in tire failure analysis. And some lawyers came down and I spent some time with them. And then they worked with the lawyer from the state's attorneys from 50 states in a RICO action against Firestone, independent of what everybody else knows about, which is the MDL that we were involved in. And the U.S. attorneys got all kind of information. I was behind the scenes guiding them in all their discovery and helped them select their expert and worked with them throughout. And they actually showed up at depositions I was taking in Ohio. It was really interesting. When they showed up in the room, the Firestone lawyers didn't know what to do, And so that was kind of fun. But it was also, we were able to change the product. They improved those light truck tires by putting in nylon overlays, which made the tires so much safer, even with the manufacturing defects they had. So that was gratifying in that we actually got a result that saved lives.
And that's what you're most proud of, is the change in behavior, the change in product safety.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm working now with the Chinese tire industry trying to help them improve their tires to make them safer. I made two trips to China and one trip to the big tire expo in Cologne, Germany, working with the Chinese tire manufacturers, encouraging them to make their tires safer and better.
What made you want to be a lawyer in the first place?
Well, that's kind of interesting. I had an uncle who was a lawyer in Wichita Falls, Texas, Frank Gibson, who was an honest, honorable man who I admired greatly. And he always held integrity to be this, the most important thing in the practice of law to him was integrity. And so that was an inspiration at an early age. But what really got me going, I was a paratrooper in the military during the Vietnam War. And as a young officer, you were called on to try cases. We had no legal training. We had one book, it was like a Bible, and the UCMJ. And that we didn't try anything that had a sentence of more than 6 months hard labor. But they were criminal cases. They're all criminal cases. And I served as a defense lawyer and a judge. I never would serve as a prosecutor. And I did that in Germany and in Vietnam. And I felt I kind of had a knack for it, and I liked it. So when I came back, I went back to Virginia Tech to finish my undergraduate degree. I had to make straight A's because my grades had been so bad in my first year. But I went back to Virginia Tech and knuckled down and made some good grades and did well on the LSAT and got into University of Florida, which, was my first choice. Mm-hmm. And here I am.
Wow. What were the most important influences in your life growing up?
Oh, undoubtedly, my father was one. My dad was a military man, and he was a devout Christian, but not in the sense of the Christianity where people have to take the Bible literally and they have to, say everything is absolutely the Word of God, but more practical Christianity. And he believed that all people were equal. He wasn't a prejudiced or bigoted person, and he really believed in integrity like my uncle. He was a man of great integrity. And he was a model for me, and he was so proud when I decided to go to law school and when I got in, and very supportive of me. So he was a great influence. I think the other big influence in my life probably was Buddy McKay. And if you know anything about Buddy McKay, you know what an honorable man he is.
Former lieutenant governor, former governor of Florida, for those who don't recollect.
Yeah, when I first started practicing with Buddy, he was a state congressman, and then he became a state senator, then a U.S. congressman, and then he came back and ran for the Senate against Connie Mack and lost in the closest race in Florida history. And that's another long story. But anyway, and then he became lieutenant governor, and then when Lawton Childs passed away, he was governor. But Buddy, in his political life, always put the country and the constituency ahead of personal interest. He always worked with the other side. He was famous throughout his career for reaching across to the aisle to the other side. And he was a master at that. But he also, and I use this word a lot because it's the people that I admire the most, he was a man of impeccable integrity and honor. And so when I practiced with him as a young lawyer, you know, what a model. I mean, after my dad, and then I got Buddy McKay, who is one of the most honorable people I've ever met, and hardworking. So, you know, he was another role model for me and had a profound influence in my life and does to this day. I still work with Buddy and working with him now on important environmental issues.
And you've practiced law with him initially.
Oh, yeah. He was my first law partner. Yeah. Well, I had others, but he was the one I really looked to.
How did you go about honing your trial skills?
You know, really, it was by doing it. One benefit of being an insurance defense lawyer is you got to try a lot of cases. And, you know, some people kind of have a knack for it, and I'm fortunate that I do, I think. And that's what I like to tell young lawyers. If you like it and you're comfortable in the courtroom, that's what you ought to be doing. If you're not, then maybe you ought to be writing briefs or doing an appellate argument or something else. You've got to be comfortable in the courtroom. And when I coach young lawyers, I tell them, when you're talking to a jury, I want you to think you're talking to people in your living room that are sitting on a couch. Just the way you'd talk to folks that were in your home that you wanted to tell a story to. And you tell that story to the jury. And that seems to have worked very well for a lot of young lawyers. It's worked for me.
Is there one skill that you can put your finger on that is the key to your success?
I think it's best summed up in a misquote from Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill is credited with this quote, "Never, never, 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 never give up." He didn't actually say that, but it's often quoted that he did. He said something similar. But I think you have to be tenacious. I think you have to be committed and tenacious. And when you get a setback, you got to put it behind you and keep going.
Well, and your point about seeking the third opinion on your initial tire case of your career.
Yeah.
And look what happened since then.
There you go.
You launched a career.
Yeah.
A very special career.
Yeah. We had to push a door open there.
Was there ever a point that you didn't think you were going to make it?
Never. I never thought that. I mean, I had some rough times. Don't misunderstand me. Everybody who's practiced law has some rough times. But no, I never thought I wasn't going to make it.
Now, you've had some delightful experiences along the way. You're one for known for enjoying life with some great, great stories. Tell us about the riding horses into the bar.
That's a pretty long story. I'll try and make it short. I was in a local bar here called O'Malley's Alley, and the bartender was a Tennessee fan, great big old boy, real nice guy. And once of us were in there drinking beer one day, and he was spouting off how Tennessee was going to beat Florida in football. And we said, you know, Billy, give it up. You're never going to beat us. Just give it up. And he's going on and on about it. And he says in a very loud voice, if Tennessee doesn't beat Florida, I'll wear a dress. About that time, the owner came in, and I told him, I said, you know, Billy's not going to get any tips in here, and we're liable to, you know, take him outside. He was a big guy. We didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. But George said, well, you said you're going to wear a dress? And Billy says, you're damn right, and I will. So I went and bought a huge dress down at the consignment shop, and they put it up on the wall in the bar. And the day came for Billy to come out. You know, we won. And George his old boss had a TV, a radio show, and he said, Billy's coming out on Thursday. So Billy's going to have to wear that dress in the bar. Well, I got a call in the afternoon from one of my cowboy buddies and said, look, I got a bunch of cows out and need help. So I didn't even think about it. I just, you know, headed out to the ranch, got my horse, and went over to his place and gathered up those cows. It rained on us, and we were pretty dirty and sweaty. It was the middle of the summer. And then I realized it was Billy's coming out. I said, oh, damn, Billy's coming out. I said, we got to get down to town. Billy's coming out. And Danny says, well, I'm not going to town like this. I said, well, your hero's Bone Mazel. He's up here in the heaven now. He looking down on you, you know, laughing at you. What are you talking about? I said, well, I don't know. So we called the bar, And I got George on the phone. I said, George, I'm out here with three cowboys out in Williston, and we got a bunch of horses. We got to come into town. And if we come into town on our horses, can we ride them in your bar? And George says, you ride them up, you ride them in. So I said, well, Danny, you can either go with me or not. But, you know, Bone Mazel rode his horse into a bar in Tampa one time. He didn't say another word. He just got on. We loaded the horses up, and off we go to town. We get to town. We unload them right out here on Magnolia, and we ride our horses right down Magnolia. It's rush hour. But, you know, Cal rush hour ain't like big town, but, you know, right. A lot of traffic.
Sure.
We get to the crossroads. We're on our horseback on the road. Danny reaches over and pushes the cross button, you know, for the light to change. All the cars stop anyway. We're cracking cow whips going down the road. Pow, pow.
Wow.
We ride up to George's bar, and the lady who was running it came, a real sweet lady, and said, what are you doing? What are you doing? George said, get out of the way, Molly. They're riding them in. We rode right into the bar. All three of us sat up there drinking Guinness on the back of the horses. And I got to finish this story now. I know it's taking a long time, but the end of it's kind of funny. Well, we're in there, and the place is packed with Billy's coming out. And Billy's got his big pink dress on. He's got his face painted with Tennessee colors. He's a great sport. And there we are. The bar is really small. O'Malley's Alley is a real thin bar. Our horses are lined up one after another. And people are trying to pet them and stuff. I mean, these are cow ponies. I'm saying, lady, it ain't a dog, you know.
Right.
But now we got to leave. I'm afraid, you know, something's going to happen, you know. Fortunately, they were all wore out. The horses were wore out, so that helped us. And they were all well-trained horses, but they weren't trained to go into a bar.
Yeah.
So I said, we got to get out of here. So Jack is behind me. I say, Jack, see if you can't get turned around. So Jack starts backing his horse, backing it, you know, like reverse, which is not easy on horses. And he hits the peanut stand and knocks it over on a guy and knocks their table, and they get Guinness thrown all over him. But the horses don't panic. He gets turned around. That gives me enough space. I get turned around. We ride out. Molly goes over to those three guys. They're in suits, and she says, she knows everybody. I know y'all never been in here before, and I'm going to apologize. We'll pay to have your suits cleaned. And the guy looks at her and says, lady, I've never been in this bar before, but you got a 6'2" cross-dressing bartender. You got cowboys riding in here and drinking Guinness on horseback. I'm coming to this bar every day.
Oh, that's great.
So he made George's bar famous.
That's great. And only in Florida, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, Florida's the original cowboys come from Florida. Original cows were in Florida. Florida was the first cattle state in the New World. In America, the cattle were in Cuba, but Florida was the original. Yeah. American cattle state.
And we're still a huge state.
Yeah, yeah. There's still a big cattle industry. Yeah. I still raise cattle.
It's amazing. Unless you fly over the state, you don't realize how rural it is.
Well, you realize when you hear that train in the background how rural it is. You know, that small southern town, you know.
Let's talk about the business of law. This is a very tough profession. What are the secrets to your day-to-day success here in the firm?
I think, as I told you, part of it's what that misquote from Churchill, but another part is, you know, you just have to be dedicated to, you know, what you believe in. You have to believe it, sincerely believe it. And then you have to be dedicated to that belief. And if you believe in something and you're dedicated, you're going to be successful. That's been my experience.
After all the successes you've had already, what keeps you going?
The fact that manufacturers that I've dealt with for decades are still making the same material misrepresentations, making the same misleading statements, using the same tactics to try and keep the truth from getting out, keeps me going day to day. If those guys would tell the truth and face up to their responsibility, I wouldn't have to keep doing this. But unless I force them to, or others like me, it's not just me, of course, then they'll continue the big lie.
And that obviously makes you mad.
Damn right it does. I've seen too many people die. I've seen too many people horribly injured as a result of intentional acts by manufacturers, by the executives of manufacturers, who don't care a thing about people's lives, who only care about their quarterly profit. And if that doesn't make you angry, there's something wrong with you.
Good point. Bruce, you've served as a board member on the Florida Justice Association, a past liaison to the Office of the Governor. What impact has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association had on your career?
It's been pretty profound. When I was a young, I say young, I mean, I don't know if I was ever young. When I was a young plaintiff's lawyer, I was asked if I would become involved with Florida Justice Association. And eventually that led to me serving on the Board of Governors. And those meetings, I learned so much and made so many contacts with people and really began to recognize how critical it was that we interact, that we share information. Sharing has been like the hallmark of my practice. Every non-protected document and deposition I can share, I share. I lecture as widely as I can. Sharing information is the only way that plaintiff's lawyers can win because we're going against major corporations. And for the longest time, I was a single practitioner and, you know, I got hired by the lawyers so I'd help. But I couldn't go up against people like Ford without interacting, you know, sharing information with other lawyers. And so that was part of what I really got from my beginnings with Florida Justice Association was how we shared information and how we worked together in common goals. And what a brotherhood it was, and sisterhood, it was a brotherhood back then, but, you know, thank goodness now it's not just a brotherhood. And so that was important to me. And also going up to Tallahassee and lobbying taught me how to be a cynic when it comes to politicians, you know, and I already knew that, but it reinforced it. Not that it's not worthwhile, don't misunderstand me, but the fact that there were so many people committed to do the right thing. So many members of this organization, their commitment is to do the right thing. Now, sure, a lot of us have made money. A lot of people made a lot of money, and that's great. It's like one of my former partners, Al Cohn, said, if you can do the right thing by people and make money, that's a double win. But you've always got to try to do the right thing. I don't know if you know this, but Al Cohn came up here to Ocala, kind of semi-retired from West Palm, and we practiced together for a while.
I did not know that.
And Al Cohn, I should have given him credit, is one of my mentors because he really was. I was further along in my practice by then, but Al had a profound influence on me. He was a decorated World War II hero. He fought all the way to Berlin. He was a young lieutenant, and his medals cover a wall. But Al was not only a courageous guy, he was someone who genuinely was driven by a desire to help people and to do the right thing by them. And that just reinforced my own beliefs and the people that I had been influenced by. So he's another one of the really important people, but he was also extremely important in FJA. He was, you know, one of the founders of ATLA and Florida Justice Association. And he strongly encouraged me, you know, to stay involved and to help. And I did. And I'm proud of him and FJA.
What words of wisdom have proven true to you along your career?
If you do the right thing, you don't have to worry about the money. Too many people get caught up in the finances of this and the money award, you know, I understand that, but I think the really best trial lawyers I know are so passionate about helping their clients that the money part's really secondary. It's nice, it's rewarding in a way, but that can't be the driving force. The driving force has to be that you want to do the right thing. And then if you do that, you'll make money.
How do you balance your professional life with your family life?
Well, that's difficult for everybody. I only had two kids, so it was a little bit easier for me than my parents who had five. I coached my son's t-ball teams and his soccer teams, and I never coached my daughter's volleyball, but I attended all of it. I have a very supportive wife who, when I was traveling around the country in trial, she would, you know, pick up the slack. So that was critical. But I spent as much quality time with my kids as I could, you know, fishing and sports and family kind of things. And being in a small town like this has helped,
mm-hmm.
you know. And there were times when I had to be away at, like, go to Miami for board meetings or, you know, I served on a basin board here one of my environmental duties, and Buddy McKay put me on that, and I had to be away for that and sometimes. But I tried to make up for it by spending time with him when I was in town, and it worked out pretty well.
What about regrets?
I guess if I was going to say I regretted anything, it's that I've not been more successful in breaking down the barrier of inappropriate protective orders that protect not trade secrets but dirty laundry. The biggest regret I have really is that I've not been able to break down that barrier despite over 30 years of effort to do that, that I'm still fighting that battle. And so much of the dirty secrets of tire companies and vehicle companies have never seen the light of day.
As we sit here, you've been practicing law for more than 45 years now. What's your view on the future of the legal profession? Do you have concerns?
Yeah, I've got concerns that you have a president who's delusional and who will appoint people to the Supreme Court that are going to set the country back decades. That's a concern I have. But on the other side of it, it's the lawyers that are saving the country. If it weren't for the lawyers in this constitutional crisis that we're undergoing now, he'd get away with it. He'd get away with everything. And he's gotten away with a lot. But the people that are going to stop him are the lawyers. I've never been prouder of lawyers, you know, Mueller, for example, but lawyers in general. Who's fighting for those kids down there on the border who get separated from their parents? That's lawyers. Lawyers are the ones who stand up against tyranny. They've done it all over the world, and they're doing it here today. And I couldn't be prouder of the legal profession. So I'm very optimistic. And young lawyers coming up who see what lawyers are doing on the border against the draconian measures by the president, that bodes well for us. Not just trial lawyers who do civil work like we do, but I think all of us, at least all the trial lawyers I know, are committed to the benefit of society beyond what we do, like me, products liability. Everybody does work that helps society in some other way. And so I'm optimistic.
Bruce, how would you like to be remembered?
Well, you know, I was once asked, when I was under oath being deposed as an expert, what my profession was. And I said, well, I'm a cowboy, red fisherman, and part-time lawyer. But I don't think that's the way I really want to be remembered.
That's not bad, though.
Yeah, not bad, really. I just hope people remember me as someone who fought the good fight for the right reason.
Bruce Castor, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.